Hello friends, it's the Environment Show and welcome. Chemicals were used in the Gulf War by the U.S. Army. New information is emerging on the use and effects of depleted uranium. One study says it causes cancers. The U.S. Army says it's less harmful than the dirt in your backyard. We'll have the story. And the Pacific Ocean literally is humming with activity as scientists study global warming. And Peter Eichhorn is very comfortable, thank you, in his house made of dirt.
The minimum temperature that the house can ever get would be 68 degrees, and the maximum would be 71.
These stories this time on The Environment Show, a national production made possible by Hemmings Motor News, the national Bible of the old car hobby, monthly from Bennington, Vermont, and by the J.M. Kaplan Fund of New York. And this is Bruce Robertson. Desert Storm soldiers may have been getting the equivalent of 50 chest x-rays an hour. According to reports from some on the front line, soldiers who served in Operation Desert Storm did not know what they were handling. The Defense Department, however, says there was no threat. According to a recently released report by the National Toxics Campaign, there was and is a threat. The report, titled Uranium Battlefields, documents the use and effects of depleted uranium, a suspected cancer-causing agent. Lenny Siegel, a researcher with the National Toxics Campaign in California, says there is reason to be very concerned.
We've called depleted uranium the Agent Orange of the 1990s in the sense that people who've been exposed to these particles in recent years may not know for a couple of decades that there's a significant health problem.
Depleted uranium, a byproduct of enriched uranium, is very dense, very heavy, and very durable. In the 1970s, the Defense Department discovered that only those missiles, rockets, and shells containing this material could penetrate thick armaments of tanks and other field artillery. The Gulf War was the first time weaponry with depleted uranium was used on such a large scale. Staff Sergeant Carol Piku is one of a growing number of war veterans reporting strange and painful ailments. Now on home duty status, 36-year-old Piku lives near San Antonio, Texas. From November 1990 to April 1991, Piku was an Army nurse on the front line of the war with Iraq. She recalls one episode.
As we were driving through Iraq, we came into a heavy artillery area that the bunkers were blown up, and the vehicles, the Iraqi tanks, APC carriers, trucks, buses, the highways, and Iraqi bodies were on the side of the roads that were charred. These bodies were actually burned. And these vehicles were still on fire as we sat in the convoy and waited there for almost an hour.
Did you know that these vehicles had been blown up with the artillery shells containing depleted uranium?
I didn't learn of depleted uranium until last month.
Piku says as early as March and April of 1991, just prior to her leaving Saudi Arabia, she began to experience strange ailments, either frequent or limited urination, frequent or limited bowel movements, extreme fatigue, hair loss, excessive weight gain, swelling of her hands, legs, and feet, and double menstrual cycles. Today, she says, these symptoms have gotten worse, and others, such as memory loss, have been added.
Since October, I notice it's progressively gotten worse. I forget to shut the stove off in my home or the oven, or I forget my keys and keep the engine running and lock the car. I forget to pick up my son at school at 3:30 every day.
Of the others who served with her on the front line, many are now reporting similar symptoms.
Depleted uranium is about half as radioactive as natural uranium that's found in the soil around your house.
Peter Esker, a spokesman for the Medical Department of the United States Army.
External radiation levels from depleted uranium are very low. In fact, workers don't need radiation monitors, you know, the film badges, for working around depleted uranium unless they're near very, very large quantities like pallets of ammunition for long periods of time.
Leonard Dietz is a retired researcher with the Knowles Atomic Power Laboratory in upstate New York. Dietz, an expert on radioactivity, says uranium is found naturally in the soil, diluted with other minerals in the soil, at 1 part to 3 parts per billion by weight. But he says there is a big difference between uranium in the ground and processed uranium.
Natural uranium is highly dilute, as I've said. It's chemically unavailable. It's locked up in minerals. It's extremely weak radioactivity per gram of soil, for example. Now, on the other hand, depleted uranium is very highly concentrated chemical form as a metal or as an oxide. It's also a point source of concentrated radioactivity, and it's available for chemical action and uptake in biological systems, whereas natural uranium is not. DPDU particles, or depleted uranium particles, either as oxide or metal, go anywhere that dust goes. It can be spread very easily by the wind over great distances.
In fact, Dietz, conducting tests a few years ago, found depleted uranium particles 26 miles from their source. He says there is probably no limit to the distance such particles might travel. He says 26 miles only because that is the farthest he happened to monitor at the time. With depleted uranium capable of traveling on the wind great distances, Dietz says, a person need not be working with or closely exposed to the substance. Residents perhaps hundreds of miles from a processing plant could be exposed to the particles, and the health effects are potentially serious.
It's a chemical poison, a known chemical poison, and also a radiological poison. The heavy metal poisoning is to the kidneys and other bodily organs if you get too much of it over a long period of time. And it only takes a small quantity. If it's deposited in the bones, it can cause leukemia. If it's deposited in the lungs, eventually it could cause lung cancer.
Dietz says soldiers working with ballistic penetrators containing typically 300 grams of depleted uranium are working with the most highly concentrated form of depleted uranium. The threat is all the more serious.
The dose rate produced by a penetrator measured at the surface is about 250 milligrams per hour. That means that chest X-ray would take about 5 milligrams. It's equivalent in terms of radiation dose rate, to 50 chest X-rays per hour.
Army spokesman Peter Esker says the Army is concerned about the medical condition of all of its troops. However, it is not believed, he says, that direct handling of depleted uranium is responsible for any illnesses at this time.
We were concerned, however, with soldiers who were involved in friendly fire incidents where they might have been injured by depleted uranium rounds.
In other words, there is concern for those like Sergeant Piku, who were near the site of explosions and fire caused by ballistics made of depleted uranium, with depleted uranium lingering in the air and borne by the wind. Depleted uranium particles created by explosions are thought to be more toxic than solid depleted uranium inside the unexploded ordnances. In fact, questions are being raised about the long-term effects of depleted uranium particles on Iraqi civilians, especially women and children, caught in or near a firestorm during the invasion. Esker says the Army does not believe depleted uranium is harmful, but they will be monitoring some 35 veterans who have come forward so far reporting strange illnesses.
We do not have any long-range studies on this. We know what the level of radioactivity is, and that's how you usually measure the potential harm of nuclear devices, is the amount and types of radiation they put out. We know that the extremely low level of this and how it doesn't even compare to radiation that you can get from cosmic rays, you know, terrestrial radiation, for instance. So based on that is why we feel that there is no health hazard. However, we think prudence dictates that we look at it more.
Esker says the medical studies will begin sometime later this year. Meanwhile, depleted uranium continues to be used, tested, stored, and disposed of at dozens of sites across the nation. Fort Riley in Kansas, the Honeywell Corporation in Hopkins, Minnesota, the Jefferson Proving Grounds, an Army establishment in Madison, Indiana, Nuclear Metal Incorporated, Concord, Massachusetts, the Savannah River Plant of the Department of Energy, and many, many other sites. If the tests run by Leonard Dietz, who showed particulates in the air 26 miles away from the source, if these tests are accurate, hundreds of thousands of citizens may be exposed to depleted uranium. The National Toxics Campaign is calling on President Clinton to open investigations into this threat and into the health problems being reported by many Gulf War veterans. The House Veterans Affairs Committee plans to hold hearings on these veterans' reports, and we'll keep you posted. This is Bruce Robertson. This fall, the Pacific Ocean will have a new sound. No, the ocean itself won't sound any different, the waves and such, but there will be a new sound in the ocean. You won't be able to hear the sound, but it will be there, says Walter Monk, professor of geophysics at Scripps Institution of Oceanography at the University of California, San Diego. Monk will be leading a team on a special project using a special, rather unheard-of method to study global warming trends by listening to the ocean.
It's not a known technique. It's something we're developing. So what we it's a rather curious way of measuring things. We think that acoustic methods provide a very good possibility for seeing whether the oceans are in fact showing some climatological changes.
This new technique is being called acoustic thermometry. Using sound, Monk will be measuring temperature changes in the ocean.
There are two key ideas behind it. One is that the speed of sound depends on temperature. And so if you measure a travel time of an acoustic pulse from a point A to a point B, if the ocean gets warmer, it would take less time.
To conduct the experiments, Monk will be beaming a certain frequency underwater from California to New Zealand, and another one from Hawaii north to the Aleutian Islands off Alaska. The sound will travel underwater at a depth of 1 kilometer, about 0.6 miles. Water at this depth, says Monk, has special sound-carrying properties. Based on some earlier experiments, Monk knows sound is able to travel underwater 10,000 kilometers, or at least 6,000 miles. Monk says this experiment will be measuring the whole ocean, and the results are expected to be far more accurate than measuring places here and there.
You do not want to make a spot measurement. If you wanted to make a point measurement, you could just take a hospital thermometer and lower it down and read it. But locally, there is a great deal of variability in the oceans. It changes from month to month and from week to week. It would take you forever to detect a slow trend, a slow change. But by measuring the average across an entire ocean basin, measuring the travel time from one point to the other at very great distances, you have a much more favorable situation for detecting a small, large-scale trend.
Monk says the sound will be a cycle of 70 hertz at several hundred watts of power. Now, to give you an idea of 70 hertz, we asked our engineers to reproduce this for us here in the studio using a tone generator similar to the one scheduled for use by Dr. Monk. It's a very low, rumbling tone, like this. Can you hear it? Like a foghorn, almost. You almost have to feel it. Monk says the tone is not expected to interfere with any marine life, though he says part of the experiment will involve observations on marine life to detect if, in fact, there are any reactions. The real purpose is to monitor temperature changes in the ocean water. Though scientists disagree on the number of degrees by which Earth is thought to be warming, Monk says there is no disagreement that oceans are important regulators of atmospheric temperatures.
If the Earth did not have an ocean, the effect would be 2 or 3 times larger than it is on an Earth with an ocean. And that's for two reasons. One is the ocean is a reservoir of greenhouse gases. In fact, most of them go into the oceans. And secondly, the ocean is an important reservoir of heat. And so if you try and understand the problem and predict it, I think it's absolutely vital that you have some knowledge of what in fact is happening in the oceans. That's why we're doing it.
The tone will be sent automatically once a day and will be automatically recorded in New Zealand and on the Aleutian Islands. Monk says the tone will take 3 hours to travel the distance. He says they are not expecting to arrive at one number to say the ocean has warmed by so many degrees. Rather, they are looking to design a sort of map showing what is happening in the various ocean neighborhoods. Some areas might be getting warmer, others might be cooling. Dr. Walter Monk is a geophysicist at the Scripps Institution of Oceanography at the University of California, San Diego. His experiment, called acoustic thermometry, will begin this fall and will continue for at least 10 years. This is Bruce Robertson. In The Natural House Book, author David Pearson writes, "Earth is the most ancient of all worked materials. In the origin myths of many cultures, the human race itself is fashioned from clay, the inert material breathed into life." Peter Eichhorn's new house, then, is really ancient.
Basically, it's what we call a rammed earth house. There are earthen modules in this house that are 2 foot thick and about 7 feet high and 8 feet long. And each earthen module is like a large adobe brick. And so we get direct gain from the sun, or the sun shines on those walls, and then that heat comes into the house about 12 hours later.
Eichhorn is putting the finishing touches on his new old house, located 2 miles in from the ocean on the coast of California near Carmel. Rammed earth is one of the oldest construction techniques known. Loose dirt is rammed down between two vertical forms, much the way cement would be poured. The densely packed dirt is extremely durable, filtering incoming summer heat and blocking escaping indoor heat in the winter. Eichhorn does not expect to need a central heating or cooling system. Further, he does not plan to draw power from the local utility grid.
We have actually eight panels on a tracker, and then a series of used NiCad batteries, and then we have an inverter that changes into 110, and which now the inverters are very efficient, and this is over 95% efficient on the inverter. And so we basically get that solar energy and use tools. Right now there's running a large beam saw. We're actually milling material from fallen trees that were on adjacent property that I owned at one time. And we're using that fallen timber to use for finishing of the house, the interior of it.
In fact, all the power tools you can hear, Eichhorn says, are being operated by solar-generated electricity, even the telephone by which he is telling us this story. The rammed earth style results in a very stable climate indoors, which is really the point here.
The minimum temperature that the house can ever get would be 68 degrees, and the maximum would be 71. But there'll actually be a 3-degree difference maximum, but we don't know if it'll be from 70 to 73 or from 68 to 71, but we will have a maximum of 3-degree change. And because the house is engineered in this way, the county actually that we're in required no auxiliary heat. Usually they require an auxiliary heat system, baseboard heat or a forced air furnace or something like that, but we have one heat source, and that's the sun, and that's all we have in the house.
To be most effective, rammed earth walls are shaded by a low, overhanging roof, like a visor on a cap. This is to make use of the angle of the sun, high in the summer, low in the winter.
In the summertime, when the sun is higher, the walls are shaded and do not absorb heat, and therefore we don't get a transference into the house. And in the wintertime, that mass absorbs the heat and transfers it in. So It's a very simple passive system. There's no, the only moving part we have, of course, is the earth. the Earth itself. I mean, the planet.
In other words, as it rotates in proximity to the sun. Eichhorn is not only a new home owner, he is a veteran house builder and has incorporated some new thinking into his structure. Namely, he goes against conventional thinking that we must insulate to prevent any heat transfer. The whole system, there by the sea in Carmel, California, is based on heat being able to pass through the walls.
The whole system uses the mass of the walls and the heat transference factor of the Earth itself. It happens that Earth transfers heat at almost an ideal rate. And so at a 2-foot thickness of the walls, it is a very ideal rate. If we made the walls actually thicker, we would get a slower heat transference and we would actually get a cooler house. It would be like living in an Earth-sheltered house or a house that's inside the Earth or something like that, where you need to put in a little bit of heat, but very little. If we made the walls narrower or thinner, and let's say like 12 inches thick, we would get the heat transference faster, and the heat would have a fluctuating, the house would have a fluctuating temperature. In other words, in the day, late in the evening, the house would warm up, and then it would cool off at night and that kind of thing. But at a 2-foot thickness, we found it's almost ideal for the heat to transfer at the appropriate time. So we get afternoon sun into the house in the early morning hours, and the same thing with the cooling. We get the nighttime cooling coming into the daytime in the summertime.
The walls are not loose dirt. The soil is mixed with about 10% cement to bind it together. Traditional ancient methods often used reeds and grasses mixed in with the dirt. When finished, the walls are coated with a sealer to bind up the surface and prevent dirt from breaking loose and filtering through the house. Eichhorn says the effect is one of a sand painting. Peter Eichhorn, near Carmel, California, building, as he says, the most elegant mud hut you ever saw, with a view of the Pacific Ocean. The house is not finished yet. He expects to move in on his wedding anniversary in June. This is Bruce Robertson. Well, that's our report on the Environment Show this week. We hope you enjoyed the report and will plan to join us next week. The Environment Show is a program about the environment, the air, water, soil, wildlife, and people of our common habitat. Next week, Saving the Siberian Tiger. And John Nahr's new book, This Land is Your Land, will have a conversation with the author. And excerpts from an address by Bruce Babbitt, Secretary of the United States Department of Interior. That's all coming your way next week. We'll be looking for you. If you know of something happening in your area that you think we ought to know about, or if you have a question about this week's or any week's Environment Show, drop us a line. Address your questions and your comments to The Environment Show, 318 Central Avenue, Albany, New York, 12206. The address, once again, is The Environment Show, 318 Central Avenue, Albany, New York, 12206. Many people request cassette copies of the program. If you'd like yours, call 1-800-767-1929. Ask for The Environment Show, program number 169 this week. You can pay by MasterCard or Visa or by check if you wish. The number once again is 1-800-767-1929. It's The Environment Show, program number 169. The Environment Show is a presentation of National Productions, solely responsible for its content. Dr. Alan Shartok, executive producer, and this is Bruce Robertson. The Environment Show is made possible by the J.M. Kaplan Fund of New York and by Hemmings Motor News, the national Bible of the old car hobby, monthly from Bennington, Vermont.